Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Diana Reyes-Bauman, Manager of California Corporate Affairs for Chevron Corporation, and your chair for the program. Tonight's program is another in our Innovating California series, a partnership between the club and Chevron to foster dialogue about solutions to some of the most critical issues facing California. This program is also being held in association with the Dartmouth Alumni Association. Our focus today is education, and specifically on the profession of teaching. We are proud to have an expert panel who will give you an insider's view of what makes great teachers and what the public and government can do to ensure that standards of excellence are set and adhered to at the primary and secondary levels. Our prominent panel includes the PBS and NPR education correspondent, two acclaimed secondary teachers, one having received the Presidential Excellence Award, and a prominent school superintendent. To begin the discussion and to introduce our panel, it is now my pleasure to welcome our moderator, a distinguished educator herself, Dr. Colleen Wilcox, Executive Director of the Silicon Valley Alliance for Teachers, former Superintendent of Schools for Santa Clara County, and a member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. I'm pleased to turn the program over to Dr. Wilcox.
Thank you so very much, Diana. It is absolutely my honor to be able to moderate this discussion with such extraordinarily distinguished panelists. And let me at this point introduce them to you. First, of course, would be Dr. John Merrill, well-known education correspondent for PBS and NPR, and the author of the book, which you will not receive tonight, The Influence of Teachers: Reflections on Teaching and Leadership. Dr. Merrill began his career as a teacher. He taught at a primarily black college. He taught in a prison, and he taught in a New York high school. He then went on and became a reporter for National Public Radio in 1974 with the weekly series Options in Education. Just 10 years later, Dr. Merrill branched out into the public television realm, and he served as host for The Merrill Report, an award-winning documentary series, and currently is the education correspondent for PBS NewsHour. Dr. Merrill's work has taken him from kindergarten classes to community colleges, from the front lines of teacher protests to policy debates on Capitol Hill. He also serves as president of Learning Matters, an independent production company that he founded in 1995. The quality of his work has been distinguished by some of industry's most prestigious awards, including the George Polk Award and two Peabody Awards. His writings include the books Choosing Excellence and Below Sea Level, and, of course, the poignant documentary on California schools, From First to Worst. Dr. Merrill holds a BA from Dartmouth College, an MA in American Studies from Indiana University, and a doctorate in education from Harvard University. Next to Kathleen, or Katie, Martin McCarthy. She is the recipient of the 2011 Presidential Award for Excellence in Teaching. She teaches second grade bilingual education at Washington Elementary School in San Leandro. She is a nationally board-certified teacher where she thrives on challenges of teaching children whose home language is Spanish. She incorporates her students' language and their cultures in all of her engaging mathematic lessons. She is one of only 85 educators nationwide to be awarded $10,000 and honored by President Obama at the White House, of course. Following an initial selection process by state officials, Katie was chosen as California's nominee for the award. Distinguished scientists, mathematicians, and educators chose her as California's winner in the mathematics field. And she received her BA at Mills College and her credential from Cal State Hayward. Stephen Thomas. Stephen is another award-winning teacher and currently the director of the De Anza High School Health Academy in West Contra Costa County Unified School District. Mr. Thomas began teaching in 2000, where he specialized in at-risk students at a juvenile detention facility. He has been at De Anza High School since 2002. Mr. Thomas's teaching at De Anza has led to improved test scores in biological sciences from below basic to proficient and advanced. Mr. Thomas also was selected by students as one of the district's outstanding teachers. As a grant writer for the De Anza Health Academy, he has witnessed at-risk students develop into college-eligible students with a focus on health care. He saw the combined GPA rise from 2.2 as those students were sophomores to 3.2 when those students became seniors, while simultaneously improving attendance and behavior issues. Of the original 36 Health Academy students, 27 are applying to four-year colleges, 2 to technical school, and 3 to the military. Currently, 160 students are now enrolled in his Health Academy, up from the original 36 students just 2 years ago. As the son of a parent in the military, Mr. Thomas spent formative years living in Germany and Japan, attended high school in Maryland, and received a football scholarship to Central State University in Ohio, where he majored in biology with an emphasis on human anatomy and physiology. He also holds an MBA from National University in San Diego. Our final panelist, Dr. Tony Smith, has been the superintendent of the Oakland Unified School District since 2009. Whew, way too young for that. As an Oakland resident and a parent of students in Oakland Public Schools, Dr. Smith is the district's first permanent locally appointed superintendent since 2003. Prior to joining Oakland's Unified School District, Dr. Smith served as deputy superintendent of the San Francisco Unified School District, earning high praise from the San Francisco school superintendent, Carlos Garcia, and the broader community for his work in the areas of innovation, instruction, and social justice. Previously, he also served as superintendent of the Unified School District in Emeryville, California, and director of the Emeryville Citywide Initiative with particular responsibility for math, science, and technology. Dr. Smith also previously served as director of the Academy for Excellence, Equity, and Leadership in Teaching at BASES, an educational nonprofit that offers coaching and technical assistance to schools and districts. He also managed relationships between UC Berkeley, 6 California high schools, and the Hewlett Foundation. Dr. Smith holds a BA in English from the University of California, Berkeley, where he was captain of the football team. He went on to earn his master's and his doctorate degrees in language and literacy at UC Berkeley. I'm exhausted, and they should be too, from all of their work. So, time is short. Let's begin. As the title implies, we want to talk about great teachers. So let me pose the first question to each of you, knowing that there's limited time here. Let me ask, if you could name only one characteristic of a truly great teacher, what would it be and why? And let me ask our first great teacher, Katie McCarthy.
I think if I could choose one word for a great effective teacher, it would be one who's reflective. A teacher who's willing to ask herself the tough questions. If a lesson went well, what didn't go well in the lesson? What would I do next time? Did my students learn what they were supposed to learn in that lesson? And a teacher who's reflective enough to know when she's not meeting her students' needs, who's willing to seek out professional development that may be not offered in her school or her school district. She's willing to pursue that, because teaching is not something that you ever master. You never become finished with teaching. It's a profession where you are constantly changing and learning better ways of doing things. So for me, the most effective teachers are the ones who are the most reflective.
Thank you. And Stephen.
I'll add on to Kathleen. What Kathleen said is absolutely true. However, one of the things that I think that's very important is to make sure that you know and understand your students. We can call them our customers, we can call them our students, we can call them our family. But if you don't understand or you don't have empathy for the type of backgrounds or the type of things that they have to go through in school and in their education, then there's going to be a miscommunication. I also think that one of the things that's very important is to embrace the kids. Try to teach them almost as though they're your own. With those kind of things, those kind of lessons towards the students, that kind of empathy, that kind of embracement, can go a long way with regards to how they feel about their passion about learning for themselves.
Dr. Smith.
I think both of those points are right on. The issue for me is about each teacher holding a vision for the children, that they can see them as architects of a positive future, and that they find ways to connect and know and have empathy for, and they have something to reflect on to serve each young person. But I think unless you really hold this belief and joyfulness about each person becoming an agent of a successful future, a lot of the other technical stuff doesn't really add up to effective, high-quality teaching.
Interesting. Thank you. And Dr. Merrill.
Must be my turn. They've said everything very well. I wouldn't go to one word. I'd say one question. I think the truly great teacher asks of each child, how are you intelligent, instead of how intelligent are you? Mm-hmm. And I think that attitude then changes everything you do if you look at a kid, because then you're looking for what that child is, has, and can be. Too often the system just says, how intelligent are you? The second question is, how are you creative, not how creative are you? We need a system which builds both of those things.
Thoughtful on all accounts. Thank you. Much of the blame for the failure of public education often gets placed at the feet of teacher tenure. I would like to ask each of you, to what extent, if any, do you think it is responsible for poor teacher performance and or poor student performance? And this time I'm going to start with Dr. Smith.
I think that the problem is not located in tenure. It's what we expect teachers to know and be able to do, and the structure that we have to support teachers to become excellent practitioners. So we have to figure out what it looks like to know kids well, to have empathy, to be a reflective practitioner. The standard of practice, I think, is uncommon. And so a lot of the conversation about Common Core or this or the next thing, I think tenure is granted too quickly without great clarity about what we're granting tenure for. I think the practice itself of teaching has to be more deeply understood. And quite frankly, I think if we were doing a better job understanding the needs of our young people and communicating and caring for teachers in ways that they need it, we'd see very different outcomes in schools. I think the question of do we tenure too quickly or not as the problem, I think, is really draws too much attention, time wasted, quite frankly, while we're not caring for practitioners and actually talking about what kids really need.
Other thoughts on tenure?
I think the obsession with tenure is completely misguided. I agree with you. I also think it's something that's greatly misunderstood by the general public. My understanding of tenure is that it grants me due process. It doesn't mean that you cannot get rid of a quote-unquote bad teacher. I'm happy to belong to a union because it also protects good teachers like me who speak out, who go to school board meetings, and who speak out. So I think tenure is not the problem, and I think the problem is the media's sort of painting that tenure is protecting all the bad teachers. So I agree with what Dr. Smith said, too.
Other thoughts?
I think I would quarrel with your assumption about the failure of public education. We have a lot of terrific public schools. But we do have a serious problem, but I would define the problem differently. I don't think the problem in education is that we have aimed too high and failed. I think we've aimed too low and succeeded. And we simply don't ask enough of our young people. And what educators too often do is talk about rigor, without apparently ever having looked up that word. It means harsh, unyielding, painful. And there is that attitude about education too often. But again, to go back to that, if you say, you know, how are you intelligent? And you talk about challenging, which I'm sure is what you do in your school, in your classes, and Stephen as well. But they say, we do not expect enough of our young people. But we'll talk about that later. Right?
Great.
Yes, I'd like to add a few comments to that. I came from the business sector before I started teaching, and one of the things that I notice is whether it's good or bad, tenure seems to slow down the transitions, the changes that are necessary in education. When I was in the private sector, when you're dealing with profit and we're dealing with business, changes in society and changes economically happen really fast, and corporations have to do that in order to stay competitive. Well, I think that the school systems should be the same way. You have to be able to adapt to the changes extremely fast, to adapt to the technology extremely fast, adapt to the new teaching modalities that take place and come along extremely fast. And sometimes some of these processes and some of these things that we have in place kind of deter that and kind of slow it down.
So the next question I pose is in the form of a fill-in-the-blank. So, prepared for that? The main reason why America lags behind so many other nations in student performance is blank. Who'd like to take that?
I would. It's that we need to heed the wisdom of Ronald Reagan, who was speaking about the Soviet Union when he said, "Trust but verify." We need to do that in education. We used to do nothing but trust. And that was a time when capable women couldn't work anywhere else and the classrooms were filled with wonderful teachers. Trust went away and has been replaced entirely by verify. Now we don't trust teachers at all. And so if you want to find a way to get to a system, a healthy system, you have to verify. You have to have tests. You have to have some way, you have to have high standards in some way of finding out if the kids are getting there and if the teachers are getting there. But you also have to start with trust. The best tests are teacher-made tests. So that would be my fill-in-the-blank. Trust but verify.
Right.
My fill-in-the-blank would be making sure that the lessons or what's being taught to the students is relative to real-world experiences. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, we give the kids a lesson and they'll look at it and think, well, this really doesn't have anything to do with me. I think that if we made the lessons or taught in a manner that made it more relevant to real-world problems, something that they can identify with, something that they can grasp on and feel that it's that they are actually a part of, that would be the biggest thing that I would do to help improve student performance.
Mm-hmm. I think America lags behind other nations because of funding. We study Finland, we study Singapore, and the teaching profession in those countries looks completely different than what the teaching profession is like in this country. So I know a lot of people might say throwing money isn't going to solve the problem, but it's a big problem.
In 1980, we devoted 8% of our GDP to education. Today it's about 5%. In 40 years ago, the average teacher salary adjusted for inflation was $49,000. Today it's $55,000. That's over 40 years. That's a raise of $140 a year for 40 years. And we do not pay teachers very well.
Mm-hmm. So I agree with much of what's been said. I do think, though, that the unwillingness of American culture, and particularly those in privilege, to really address the stripping of opportunities from certain communities and the structured racialization, the history of oppression in the country, and our inability and unwillingness, quite frankly, to fund based on need. And we look at areas of concentrated poverty, and we're not really addressing the kinds of support that young people need, and in fact, blaming children for being hungry when they come to school is different than looking at the systems that we sit in. And so as we underfund and strip money away from educators who want to do everything they can, and we haven't funded, and in fact, you have a great example in California. The more diverse California has become, we've seen a precipitous drop in funding and a reliance on the local community to pick up the tab. Well, when you have inequities in your own community and the state fails to care for its children, you have the criminal outcomes that we have. So I think I agree with you, but still you have to look at what – I think the blank was, why do we lag behind? Because we have failed to really acknowledge that we don't value every child the same way, and we haven't made a concerted effort to change that, I think.
Tony, are you suggesting that other nations do?
Well, I think obviously we have a situation where we're much more heterogeneous. We have a bigger effort, and to create a healthy democracy and to believe that everybody who comes to this country has the right to be well prepared to participate, I think that that looks very different. So the mission, and I would pick up on what John said, I mean, we have aimed too low. To fundamentally believe in the capacity and brilliance of each child and create the conditions for those children to become great, that takes funding that I don't even think we've thought about yet.
It not only takes funding, it takes a shift in attitudes right now. Just quickly, some of you in this room are more than 30 years old. Anyone over the age of 30, there were basically three justifications for school. That's where they kept the knowledge, at the school. That's no longer true. It's now 24/7 floating around everywhere. You went there to be socialized. Hey, today there's an app for that. You know, and the third reason you went to school was custodial care. And that still applies. But the other two do not. So you need an entirely different kind of school. It's not just money. You need and we have these answer factories. That's totally inappropriate. We need teachers who will help our kids sift through this flood of information. Information is not knowledge. Our kids are digital natives. They're not necessarily digital citizens. There's a whole different role for school. The socialization thing, I joke about the app, but our kids are socialized. It's like pen pals on steroids. They're socializing with other 14-year-olds. But whoops, that 14-year-old might actually be a 40-year-old congressman. Trolling. And we know it's happened. So schools have to help kids understand that technology is far more permanent than a tattoo. When they start sending something around, it goes around forever. And so it's not just funding. It's a real change. Tony talked about the economic divide. That's getting worse because the digital divide is very, very real. And kids have to have those skills and those tools and that access, it's going to take some real investment and wise investment, I would argue.
Several of you have touched on that things are changing. You've mentioned it in your responses. And I've often heard that everything in the world has changed except the classroom. What will it take from teachers, classrooms, school districts, to prepare our students for our future?
Well, I think Stephen and Katie actually hit on so the ability of a teacher to reflect and look at their practice and the outcomes with their young people and their students, but to prepare them to be able to participate and go forward, the relevance. So this question of not just being researchers anymore or inquirers, but to really become makers, to look at the kind of programs that are out there and to give young people problems that they have to solve that have bugs in them, to unpack and to understand. I mean, it's some of the stuff that you were describing. Like, how is it that this is what's going to help you gain entry into the world that's coming, the world that you know in some ways better than we do? I mean, this is about learning together and creating the relationships. I mean, I think there are extraordinary classrooms. I mean, if I walk into some classrooms, I'm like, wow, this is just exactly what it should be and could be. And the fact is, though, that we don't have the kind of facilitated, thoughtful learning of adults in schools that help them share that with each other. And, I mean, there are places where it's already happening. But the structures that make that live in the culture of a school, I think that's a big part of how we go forward, that this is where we need to go, everybody, not just a couple really extraordinary teachers like we have here, but this is just the craft, and that's really the change I see that needs to happen.
Beyond funding, one of the things that I've noticed working with my students is to, like someone else said earlier, is to really share the vision. Share the vision with them of their future, including with technology, including with real-world applications, and to make them understand that too often we try to make their vision our vision, when in reality it should be their own vision, shared with our vision. And I think the more that a teacher, just like a parent, tries to lead a student along, I think that's one of the most important things and probably would give the student the most value added to his education. So if he understands the vision of where he's trying to go and what we're trying to do as teachers to try to give him all the tools, whether it be technology, whether it be creative thinking, whether it be leadership skills, whether it be problem-solving skills, whatever, is to have a vision of why he's doing this and how these skills and how this vision is going to transform his world, different from the absolute thing that we're talking about here.
I really like how, Dr. Smith, you mentioned relevancy in the classroom, because I know that in my own classroom, you know, we prepare all year long for the state tests that No Child Left Behind mandates. And, you know, we read these passages, and it is simply not relevant to what's happening in my students' classroom and their home life. And I agree, we need to make education relevant and exciting again, because it's the curiosity is being killed. It's being killed. We are so focused on math and reading and writing, and science is simply not being taught enough. Arts is not, social studies not. And I hope that we get back to making education relevant and fostering curiosity in students, so that they want to come to school every day.
My sense of the classroom that would be vibrant would be a classroom or a building that the kids are in that room, but they do not respect the walls. That is to say, they use the technology so that they're connecting with kids, not necessarily in the same building, with kids all over the country. You know, Berlin, New Hampshire, and Berlin, Germany, or Paris, France, and Paris, Texas, to be glib about it. But there's the technology is such that, look, the challenge is to have our kids not be consumers, but be producers. Mm-hmm. And that's really the trick. That's really the goal should be. And what we do now is, Kathy was saying, that we're just asking them to regurgitate. Mm-hmm. And regurgitation education is not going to cut it. Look, you could have kids, I live in New York City. You can look out my window, and I can see on the corner, there's a trash can on each corner. And we were filming in the South Bronx, and I noticed there was just one trash can on four corners. I started thinking, well, what if, and my neighborhood is nice and neat. So instead of calling them trash cans, call them cleanliness opportunities. And then mobilize all the seventh graders all across the city to take a smartphone and take pictures and then share the data. And you could do a map of the cleanliness opportunities in the entire city. You can take it to the mayor and say, how come they're more here and not there? That's real work. Right. That's creating knowledge. And it's useful knowledge, you know, political, and the teacher can do that. And if you don't want to go down to the corner, you can get an air quality monitor and go right outside the school. But the key is not to respect the walls. Not to respect the walls. You've got to get out
but
there.
But a teacher can't do those kinds of lessons when she's handed a scripted curriculum and a pacing calendar that says, on this day you will teach missing addends.
Right. And that's that trust but verify. I mean, that's why we got to talk to Tony Smith about changing stuff. He's a superintendent.
I think this is a perfect time for a little housekeeping to remind our radio audience that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we're discussing how to create and nurture great classroom teachers. Our panelists are Dr. John Merrow, education consultant for PBS and NPR, Katie Martin McCarthy, recipient of the 2011 Presidential Award for Excellence in Primary School Mathematics and Science Teaching, Stephen Thomas, science teacher and director of the De Anza High School Health Academy in the West Contra Costa Unified School District, and Dr. Tony Smith, superintendent of the Oakland, California Unified School District, and I'm Dr. Colleen Wilcox, moderating today's panel. Well, it seems to me that it would be a good time to talk about what if. What if each of you were given $1 billion to affect California schools or any other state schools? Where would you earmark your money and why? Dr. Smith. Please.
I'm excited. So I think with $1 billion, particularly in California, currently, obviously, we've been robbed of funding, and our kids have been just criminally underfunded. I think, interestingly, I would probably use a big portion of that money to lobby federally. And I think when you look at Title I funding, for example, 31 other states receive more Title I funding than California does. It's a formula-driven section that we are, because of our lack of effort to fund and care for our children in California, we're less eligible for funding nationally. So the lack of investment in our kids, I feel like at the county level I get support, and at the federal level I get support. And when I apply for federal, at the state level in California, we have failed to care for children. And I think, granted, it's only about $159 per kid if you distribute it across the 6.3 million children, school children in California. But I would really talk about, unless there's a bailout package for California, we currently have about 1 in 13 people in the workforce either is in or comes from California. And as we talk about the United States having a chance to compete in the global economy, if we don't really pay attention to what's happening in California and care for our children, we're in big trouble as a country.
So you'd use the money to lobby for more money. Okay.
Amen.
Stephen.
Yes. I'll let the leaders talk about lobbying for money. I'll just deal with what I need to do in the classroom. Of course, teachers could always use more pay. We could always have more teachers being staffed. But, of course, one of the things that I would really like to see is for the ability to have teachers work collaboratively more, if I said the word right. Mm-hmm. There needs to be time set aside where teachers can have not just common pacing guides and common standards, but common kind of projects that they can work on together. We call them integrated projects at our school, so that they can tackle real-world problems as collaboratively as a team, with each teacher having their input from their specialty with regard to curriculum. I would like to see technology updated more efficiently and faster, and updated with the ease what happens in the private sector. I think there needs to be a lot more
business partner relationships and mentorships between the students and the business partners and the community. I think some of the students, particularly mine, who are at risk, don't get a lot of the opportunity to mentor or business partner with some of the professionals out there to share their learning experiences. Maybe funding might help them bridge that gap, and we could reach out to more business partners, and they could reach back to us to fund those kind of programs. And definitely always more professional development for the teachers. When we do have teachers that are struggling with certain things, if you don't have the funding to help move those students, those teachers along, then you're spinning your wheels.
With $1 billion, I think number one, I would try to lift every child that's living in poverty out of poverty, because there's only so much a teacher can do with a student who is homeless, does not eat breakfast, has a parent that's working three jobs. So we cannot over emphasize the effects that poverty has on children and the schools. And I would also devote a lot of money to professional development, paying for teachers to seek national board certification, rewarding teachers for earning national board certification, because California has zero incentive for that. And for me anyway, it was the most just incredibly rewarding experience going through that process.
Katie, can I ask you to touch on that just a little bit more?
Can I just say how I spend my billion or not?
Well, you may, but after she tells us a little bit about National Board Certification for Teachers, I'm delighted to hear it. You will get an opportunity. Katie, I think a lot of our audience probably is not aware of National Board Certification. Can you address it slightly?
Okay. It's a voluntary advanced teaching credential. And many people don't know about it, but it's considered the gold standard for teachers. And what it requires is teachers to videotape themselves in the classroom and reflect on it, write papers about it, document what you do as a professional inside the classroom, outside of the classroom. And also you have to take exams to demonstrate your content
knowledge.
Other
people look at your videos, right?
A committee looks at them, yeah. You send them to people you don't know, and they don't know you. It's completely anonymous.
How long did the process take?
It can take 3 years. I certified the first time, so it took me a whole year. It takes about 300 hours on average. So my whole year was dedicated to that. Basically, every weekend, every vacation.
Do you get a pay bump the way they do, say, in North Carolina for being board certified?
I don't in my district. Some districts do have money set aside for that. My district doesn't.
Okay, so thank you on that. Now,
I guess.
Now,
talk about your $1 billion.
Well, it's going to go very fast.
Spend that billion.
Well, I agree with some of the other priorities, but I think we should spend more money on the tests we give. Right now, we spend 15 cents out of every $100 on the tests, and then we judge our teachers by these lousy crap, I can't say that on radio, tests. And I would ask you to contrast how you treat your car with how we treat our kids. I drive a used Toyota 4Runner that costs $12,000 and spend about $500 every year evaluating that. That's, what, 4%? We spend, evaluating our kids, we spend 1/15th of 1% and then make all these decisions about teachers and kids. So I'd spend money on better tests. I'd also, however, want to spend some money to bring back art, music, and phys ed, as Katie said earlier. And then the last, I'd set aside some money to pay the legal fees of the teachers who were willing to defy this crazy standardized test system.
So I agree. And the importance that I was drawing is that it's one-time money, and I would always trade one-time money for ongoing money. Mm-hmm. And so the billion that I get, I would invest to keep being able to fund and do the right things. Because one-time money, $1 billion, when you spread it across each of the children in California, it's actually not enough.
Point well taken. Yeah. Now let's talk about money in general. There are a number of questions that the audience has posed regarding what impact the budget cuts we're experiencing in California will have on the quality of teachers and the nature of their teaching in the classroom. And so let's start from there. What effects will it have on our educational system?
The budget cuts, well, for example, in my district, kindergarten through third grade used to have 20 students per teacher. They now have 28. That's a 40% increase. So teachers are not happy. They are stressed. They are blamed for everything. So teachers aren't going to want to continue teaching in that environment. So budget cuts are real. We've lost teachers at my school. Good teachers. Really, really passionate, effective teachers. That's the biggest difference. We've taken pay cuts. We've, you know, voluntarily done so. So budget cuts are real. They're not just on paper. Teachers already pay for all kinds of supplies in their own classroom. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of dollars come out of my pocket every year for basic necessities. And it's just getting worse. I mean, they're saying we might go back up to 32 students per teacher. And in the good old days, you know, I have older colleagues who remember 32 students with an aide. These are students that, yeah, there's no aides in public, in my district anyway. So, yeah, budget cuts are real. And they have real classroom. It's very visible what's happening in my classroom.
Stephen, your thoughts, particularly as it relates to STEM education, science, mathematics, technology.
I would agree with what Katie said. Mm-hmm. We could talk about the overcrowded classrooms, the lack of supplies that we have, the amount of resources the teacher has to use to supplement that. But the other thing is there's a shortage of teachers when we have teacher layoffs. I think that at our school, we have quite a few teachers who teach full-time from, we call it bell to bell, which is great instruction, but really there's no time to actually plan a lesson. They're teaching every single minute of the day. The only time that you do have to reflect or to grade papers or to put your lesson plan together or to deal with a student is in the after hours. And there's just not enough hours in the day. I was speaking to someone not too long ago and asked them what I could do to help them, and they asked me for 13 more hours a day in their time. But the budget cuts do that. They curtail us from proper planning. I even asked one of the students today what they thought would make a good teacher, and they were saying that we'd like to see teachers better organized. But how can we stay organized when we don't have the time to organize? We're busy teaching all the time. It's hard to reflect. So,
I mean, I think the funding situation is destroying our capacity to prepare a workforce. And if you think about the health and well-being of our cities, I mean, right now we are setting ourselves up for a very, it is a disaster. And so if you look at what we ask teachers to do in classrooms, and we've taken away supports and added more and more young people into classrooms with greater and greater need, you know, the kind of counseling services was in high school today, and young people talking about, you know, I'm working a job, my parents are working two jobs, I don't even know if I can keep coming to school. I mean, the kinds of needs the kids are expressing. I have a high school that's at now about 80% free and reduced lunch, which is for a 1,800 student high school. It's pretty significant, these kids are reporting. So the needs are going up as the economy has faltered. We're underfunding education, and we're not thinking thoughtfully about the kind of linkages to economic and workforce development. So you're preparing teachers with deeper content, giving them time to reflect, plan, and work together to really prepare different kinds of pedagogy, ways of engaging, to deepen the profession. Taking almost all of that out, and now expect those teachers to do more with kids who have greater need. You know, and there are families that are with affluence that then pay for the very thing that every kid deserves. So we're in a, I think, a very dangerous situation in terms of public finance.
It's ironic that we're doing it at a time when we're talking about competing with Shanghai and Finland and so on and so forth. Teachers in those countries basically have the time, as Stephen, Katie, do not. They have time to reflect. They have time to work together. In those places, teaching is a team sport. There's no country in the modern world where teachers spend more time in front of kids. It's an all-day job. It's bell to bell, as you said. That makes no sense. You should have some time to reflect. I mean, we're asking our teachers now to do more for more kids, but with less. It makes no sense. I mean, just playing with this idea of, one out of every 100 Americans is a public school teacher. So that they are the other 1%, if you will. And the guy who is number 75 on the Forbes 500, number 75, he makes more money in one day, every day, 365 days a year, than the average teacher makes in a year. There's something wrong with this picture. Number 28 on the list of athletes is a guy named Carl Crawford in the Boston Red Sox, who had a very disappointing year, hit 255, 11 home runs. He makes more in one day, every day, 365 days a year, than the average teacher makes in a single year. There's something wrong with that picture.
I'm getting a little depressed, so I'm going to change the topic.
Actually, before you, so part
absolutely.
Of the, I would offer that the rules, regulations, and agreements that districts and organizations have entered into with union leadership actually protects a time that we're past. Mm-hmm. So the kinds of teachers that we have here talking about the kinds of collaboration, how time should be structured, what good looks like, I think we need to be having these kinds of conversations about what kind of agreements do we need to protect and support quality and effective instruction. So maybe this links all the way back to the first question. If you go to seniority as different than tenure, and just if you've been around and you should have the job, I actually don't agree with that. But if you're talking about connecting and learning and reflecting and building capacity among your staff, that's the kind of stuff that we should superfund, as far as I'm concerned.
The school should make the decision?
So I think definitely.
How many pages is your contract in Oakland Unified?
It's very long. Many addenda.
Because the union contract in say, Finland is fewer than 20 pages.
Right. So,
that's a professional union, not a trade union.
Yeah, but this is where I think honestly recognizing the moment we're in and the kinds of needs that we have now, this is time to refashion those agreements around the kind of practitioners we have here, talking about what good looks like in service of children and how then do we fund that and have those kind of autonomy sitting at the school site with teachers. I mean, that's the future for me, and I think that's what we should argue for funding. I mean, that's the kind of change around high-quality instruction, effective instruction, teaching as a valuable professional practice. I mean, that's where we got to go.
Let me ask you from your various perspectives, what on earth is working in public education, in schools, in policy, in administration?
I would just say teachers like these two here, they continue to give blood. The other 1%, I mean, Kathy mentions how much she spends. The average teacher spends $500 or $600 of his or her own money. I doubt very much if the guy from Honeywell, who's number 75, I doubt if he buys supplies for his office, but she buys supplies. They buy supplies for their office. That's part of what's working, is an incredibly capable, dedicated group of teachers that we're not treating very well. And when you don't treat them well, it's possible to turn them sour. And I'm sure you have colleagues who have kind of given up.
Left the profession.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can you just address two situations which would improve the treatment of teachers? In treating them better? Yes. How would we?
Well, I would do what Stephen said. I actually would agree, start with Tony. He said if you redo the agreement, so those decisions are made at the school level. Get capable principals who work with a team and say, well, how do we want our day to work? you don't have to have a class size rule if you say, well, let's have a small one here. And I mean, but you have to trust the professionals. That'd be the first thing.
Okay. Katie, your thoughts on that?
I think the seniority topic is probably, well, it could be for another, a whole other discussion, actually. And I agree with you, I think sometimes one size doesn't fit all. And I teach in a Title I school that has great, great needs. Class size is more important at a school like mine, actually, than probably at a suburban school where, you know, the students aren't coming from poverty.
Thank you, Stephen.
There's something that I've noticed to go along with the teachers are our greatest resource right now, and so are our students. But a program that, outside of the things that we do as teachers, a program that I've seen that I'm pretty impressed with is something that's called Teach for America. If anybody's familiar with it, they're recruiting some of these students out of college and training them to come into the high schools or to the schools right away and get into the profession of teaching. It's luring some very, very bright young students, change them into teachers. They have a nice internship type of program to train them to be teachers. That's something that I think is an outstanding program that seems to be working so far. I don't know how old it is.
20 years. 20th anniversary. Mm-hmm.
For some reason, in our district, it seemed like the pace has picked up with regards to the hiring. So there's one thing that's working is we are getting a new generation of students that or teachers that are recognizing the problems and the pitfalls that we're having and are ready to address those concerns.
Tony?
Yeah, I think that there are many things that are working. I think the kinds of schools where teachers and principals are working around a shared vision of what success looks like for young people. They have common agreements about the way they're going to engage and work with families, that they partner with outside community-based organizations, that the school is a place of belonging and connectedness. So they really talk about personalization, content. They're always building their content awareness. There are schools like that. There are not whole districts like that. And, in fact, many districts are organized, and the teacher culture and the education culture often tears down those places of success. So we've got to do a much better job of protecting what's working, learn from it, and expand it. I do think programs like Teach for America, kind of introduction of new ideas and charters, that the intention behind some of the competition was to learn from and provoke. Some stability questions. I mean, in many of our communities, creating a stable, connected sense of belonging in a school is essential. And so how do you do that? And what part is outside Teach for America? What part is charter and some kind of competition engagement? What part is in district? And I would offer that unless we actually have honest dialogue about all that and move away from the ideology of, well, it can't be that and not, no, you won't be able to do this, until we actually say, what do our kids need? And design new systems that actually incorporate all of the things that are working, we're not going to make progress.
I've got to add this piece because I have a health academy. And we've brought that into our school. We've also brought in a law academy, and we've also brought a technology academy into the school. And this is something that I do see that is really working very well because, as Dr. Smith said, it addresses what the students want and what the students need. I mean, oftentimes a student is at school, and he's like, well, why am I here, and what's in it for me? I want to do this. I want to be that. So with these type of academy models, it's presenting the students an opportunity to actually start preparing for a career pathway and incorporate their education into that career pathway. And I know at our school it has changed the whole vision. It has changed the whole atmosphere. It has changed the students' passion for coming to school and learning because they do see a pathway for them, not just coming to school to graduate or because my parents said so, but actually I can tie it to something that I want to do when I graduate.
Yeah, the work-linked learning is essential.
And,
a
clear focus in the school as well.
Yes. And it drives collaboration, too. So it's not just about, hey, the world of work. It's linking curriculum inside the school. It drives an opportunity for people to be in relationship. I mean, the career academies, the pathways, I would definitely say that's something that's working, too.
Now, the next couple of questions I ask, you're all going to want to respond to, but I'm going to ask one individual each question. And the first one I want to ask is Stephen, and I want to ask you about technology, because there are so many questions from our audience that it's going to be impossible for all of us to respond to all of them. But Stephen, talk to us about the pros and cons of technology in the classroom and in our schools and how best to use it and what to avoid.
I don't see any cons about technology in our classroom. Our society is becoming a technology-driven society. These students are very technology savvy. For them to have some of the tools at their disposal, an iPad, a cell phone, and then to come back into a classroom where we're working in the medieval times is not very conducive for them, and it's not very interesting and fun for them. We try as best we can to get as much technology into our lesson plans, provide them with the tools that are necessary to do that. And also, in our district, we're dealing with a lot of students who are at risk. And some of them don't have that technology in their schools, or at their homes. So for them to be able to have access to it at their schools would only allow them to be competitive with some of the, as Dr. Smith said, some of the more affluent schools and much more competitive in the global educational market.
Thank you, Stephen.
Can I just say that we have to remember that technology, that computers may have the answers, but they don't have the questions. And that's the role of the school, is to help kids formulate questions so they can separate wheat from chaff.
And now, John, that's not your question, but thank you oh so very much.
I didn't even raise my hand.
So, Tony, it's only been mentioned once by yourself, the topic of charter schools, which I'm sure is on many people's minds. Pros and cons of charter schools as a superintendent in Oakland Unified School District.
It's interesting. I think the original intent of the charter, when Senator Hart really pushed that to happen about 1992, I think, the idea that parents and community could organize when they were not getting their needs met, I think is essential. I think we have to create places where children and teachers and parents or caregivers are in good relationship and children are getting the support they need. And that's not happening in all of our in-district public schools. It's not happening in all charter schools either. I think the ability, though, and what it drove was a change in policy and a mindset that, you know what, actually every kid does deserve effective, high-quality instruction and support. So in that regard, I think it's been a powerful change. I do think, though, over the long haul, particularly in California, if we're not paying close attention to the need of all children, so the public school system currently is required to serve every child in the city, in its district boundary.
Thank you, Tony.
And just real quick, so the challenge is that charters are not. So you could have a set of charters and have children and families who are not accepted or served in a school. That's not acceptable to me, and it's not acceptable to democracy. So the conversation, though, about what the appropriate role of charter, that's a conversation we've got to keep having, and it's not they should be stopped. It's how do you work together in service of children, and what role does charter have to play in that?
Thank you, Tony. And Katie, what role does the teacher and perhaps the parent have in bullying, a topic that we hear so much about these days? How do you see your role, the role of the principal, the district, the parents?
In my district, we've done a lot of work on bullying because it's come to light the effects of bullying, especially against children who are gay, children who are of color. And I think for too long, parents, maybe teachers, I don't know, have just sort of thought it was a rite of passage of being in school. And I think it's wonderful that it's finally coming to light that bullying hurts. And we have children who are committing suicide. So the role that teachers have, rather, is that they cannot tolerate it anymore. And we've had some terrific professional development in my district on that, on how to have conversations about bullying with children as young as kindergarten all the way through high school. And sometimes that conflicts with what the message is given at home. But teachers have to set the climate in their classroom, and teachers are the ones that have to say that is not okay to say that in this classroom, that is unacceptable, and that there are consequences for certain kinds of words, because words hurt.
Thank you, Katie. The last question is for Dr. Merrow here, and that we've talked about the classroom, we've talked about the school, we've talked about the teacher and the student. Let's look at district reform. You have become the guru on district reform. Can you tell us what's working?
Yeah, but may I first?
Of course.
The bullying question is a profoundly important because of technology. Which is why, I mean, cyberbullying allows kids to bully anonymously, which is why it's critical that schools, that teachers work with kids and help them understand that power of technology and help them use it in positive ways to create knowledge. Idle hands do the devil's work. They do double devil's work with technology. Charter schools, if you set a high bar for charters, things will be fine. But they hand them out like Halloween candy in Texas and Arizona, and charter schools fail. What did you ask me? Yeah. District.
In 30 seconds, okay. Tell me about New Orleans.
We're editing. We filmed in New Orleans for 6 years, starting almost immediately after Katrina, and it's a remarkable story. It's called Rebirth in New Orleans. It has to do with charter schools, has to do with Teach for America, but it has to do with people putting their egos behind the door. And it's hard work. But when they started 20% proficiency, they're now at 60%. That's not victory, but it is possible, but it's taken a long time. It takes people like Tony, but also a whole raft of community people reaching out into the community and saying, we're going to make sure, we're going to ask, how is this kid intelligent? It's really a terrific story, and I hope you all watch it when we finally finish.
And
it.
Read his book. Fully discussed there. Unfortunately, we have reached the point in our program where there is time for only one last question. And I sit here with approximately 45 more questions from our audience. So, let me end by asking, can you tell us a motivational story that you've experienced about teaching and learning? And Dr. Merrow, I'm going to start with you.
I taught in high school. I went back to my kids. The kids asked me back to their 40th reunion. And, of course, by then we were about the same age, but they still called me Mr. Merrow. And a whole bunch of young people, old people, came up and told me. And, of course, none of the kids whose lives I ruined came up to me, just the ones who felt I'd helped. And it's where I got the title for the book, The Influence of Teachers. I was just reminded of the profound the influence that teachers have on young people. And that's the, if I ask you to close your eyes and think of a favorite teacher, somebody will come into your head like that. And that's an incredible, we owe so much to these teachers that we have today, and we need to do more.
Appropriate return to Katie now.
I had one very recently, about 2 weeks ago. I went to visit a former student of mine who's now in fourth grade, and I was just checking in on her just to say hello, and I asked her, well, how's fourth grade going? What's your favorite thing? She said, my favorite subject is math. And in my classroom, she was, wow. She did not understand the concept of subtraction. And to hear her say that, math is her favorite subject, just wow.
Congratulations,
everything
Katie.
To me. Yeah.
Stephen.
In my pathway, I have a student who's a senior now who was so thrilled when we brought our health academy to De Anza because her lifelong passion was to become a dentist. And she's just thrilled with the academy. She's going to graduate, but throughout the years, she's been able to intern at a couple of dentist offices. She's a model student. She's on her way. But as a result of that, she said one of the most profound things to me is she came up to me and she just smiles all the time because she's so happy with the academy and what she's doing. And I asked her, I said, well, why is it you chose this pathway and why did you join the health academy and why are you so passionate about what you want to do? And she told me, she said, because she wants to fix little kids' smiles.
Dr. Tony Smith.
That's good. Mine's really a personal story. I attended a different elementary school every year growing up, and it was really part of why I do this work, quite frankly, is because there were some schools where teachers literally reached out and cared for me and knew that I didn't have the support I needed, and they saw in me something that I didn't see in myself and kept kind of coaching me and nurturing me and nudging me. In other places, I didn't get that. And so I think for me, it's the care and concern that the teachers held and their expectation for my healthy future that I'm trying to create the conditions that they can do that for more kids now.
Thank you to our panelists. Dr. John Merrow, education correspondent for PBS and NPR. Katie Martin McCarthy, recipient of the 2011 Presidential Award of Excellence. Stephen Thomas, science teacher and director of De Anza High School Health Academy in the West Contra Costa Unified School District. And Dr. Tony Smith, superintendent of the Oakland, California Unified School District. We also want to thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. This program has been part of the Commonwealth Club of California Innovation Series, underwritten by Chevron Corporation. This program has also been held in association with the Dartmouth Alumni Association. I'm Dr. Colleen Wilcox, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place to be in the know, is regrettably adjourned.